Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Last April, EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler announced the agency was going to retain a piece of legislation called the National Ambient Air Quality Standard for Particulate Matter without changes. The move has been heavily criticized by environmental advocates. Historically, the Lancaster, Harrisburg, and Lebanon regions have had some of the highest levels of particle pollution in the country. Here to talk about the rules that are to stay in place and opposition to them is Kevin Stewart, Director of Environmental Health at the American Lung Association. Mr. Stewart, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. It's good to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Kevin Stewart, we've had you on the program before, usually when the American Lung Association puts out its report card. So some of these questions I've asked several times before, but I want to provide some context for our audience. What is particulate matter?
Yeah, particulate matter is a lethal air pollutant. It's made up of microscopic specks of soot, metals, acids, dirt, air toxics, aerosols. It can be a combination of solid particles and tiny, tiny liquid droplets. And they're small enough to inhale into the deepest parts of the lungs. Those fine particles that are much smaller than the diameter of a human hair can get into even the bloodstream and affect the heart, so that we know that people have an increased risk of heart attack and death as a result of exposure.
Well, I want to talk about some of the health impacts. It's not just heart attacks, but there are some other unhealthy conditions that particle pollution can lead to. What are some of them?
Well, we know that breathing particles can trigger asthma attacks, so people who have asthma are more likely to experience episodes, need medication, visit the doctor, go to the ER. Particles have been identified to have components that cause lung cancer. They increase, as I said, the risk of heart attacks and strokes. They damage the lung tissue and the airways, increasing hospital visits for respiratory, cardiovascular problems. And they're also linked to some things people may not be aware of, like they contribute to cognitive decline, such as dementia, can impact pregnancy and birth outcomes, those kinds of effects.
You mentioned pregnancy, and I just saw a story this morning about a study that showed that air pollution, including particle pollution, they think could be much more, and I can't quote the exact study, but that this story said that it could be much more dangerous for African-American women who are pregnant. So it just goes to show that this is something that is going on all the time. Why is central Pennsylvania a hot spot for particle pollution?
There are a number of reasons. We are in the eastern part of the United States where there are higher population densities. We are not only producing a lot of air pollution ourselves, we have around 3 million people who live in the WITF listening area, but we know that we are also downwind from sources of air pollution, such as the Baltimore, Washington area, and we are also downwind from western Pennsylvania, the Ohio Valley, where there are sources of air pollution that put fine particles into the air that come our way. So altogether, those add up to create a problem in our own neighborhood, even if we're not the largest metro areas in the country.
Many people may not think about that, about being downwind and how the wind, but when you picture it, I mean, it makes sense. But we're talking about very small, fine particles that can move. I don't know how far they can move, but I imagine cover a great deal of area. Go ahead. What were we going to say?
Sure, hundreds of miles, yeah.
Hundreds of miles, okay. But here in central Pennsylvania, there are some conditions that produce some of these fine particles because agriculture, for example, is one of the sources for fine particles, as well as, you know, you mentioned traffic, I mean, vehicles, for example. With the interstates that are going through central Pennsylvania, there are so many trucks, there are so many vehicles coming through. Those are just two factors, aren't they?
That's right. We know that there is a great variety of sources, certainly those that are associated with combustion. So we know that coal-fired power plants are among the key sources nationally, industrial boilers, diesel vehicles, as you mentioned. Wildfires have been important out in the western United States as a source of these. But then even locally, we have plenty of traffic. We have individuals who are engaging in the economy, especially as things open up more. There are sources such as wood burning and trash burning that contribute to air pollution. And some agricultural operations have a component as well, because we know that ammonia is a precursor of fine particle pollutions and particle pollution, and Lancaster County is one of the highest areas in the country for producing ammonia.
Well, you mentioned Lancaster, and I was going to ask about Lancaster County in particular, because Lancaster County, historically, when you put out your report cards, and there are other organizations that measure pollution as well, Lancaster County, even though, and again, I've said this many times, that so many people picture Lancaster County as idyllic, and it is, but it also has one of the highest rates of air pollution in the country. Maybe just a little bit more than, say, Harrisburg, Lebanon, Carlisle, certainly more than York County. What is it about Lancaster County in particular?
It's a really complicated issue. You know, we do know that based on our most recent State of the Air report, based on data from 2016 through 2018, we were ranked at 27th worst for the long-term annual average particle pollution out of 204 metro areas around the country. I think if I'm remembering correctly, I think the Harrisburg, York, Lebanon metro area was about 41st worst for that measure. So it does give you some idea that we have these high numbers. I think part of it is just simply the matter of, in addition to the local sources that are very unique, such as the highest levels of ammonia in the area, we do know also that we're downwind additionally, so that York County, for instance, is downwind from Adams and places to the west. Well, Lancaster County is downwind from Adams and places to the west, but we're also downwind from York County. So it does give you some idea that there is a background level as well that's contributing to this. But there are people at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection who can really give a much more nuanced analysis of what the reasons might be for the air quality levels differences. But we know that we clearly have a problem, and that's one of the reasons why we're here today to emphasize that the current air quality standard itself is weak and has been identified as weak since 2010, when we were testifying around that time for a stronger particulate pollution standard, and it still hasn't changed.
All right, so let's talk about that. What exactly is the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington proposing here?
The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to keep the current inadequate particulate matter standard, and the American Lung Association emphasizes that that is completely unacceptable for a number of reasons. First of all, the science clearly shows that stronger limits are needed to protect public health, and the science has shown that for a long time. The other thing, of course, is that the law itself requires that the ambient air quality standards have to be set at a level that is, I'll quote from the law, requisite to protect the public health with an adequate margin of safety. And those are things that the current standard definitely does not do and needs to be improved upon.
When were these standards enacted?
Well, the original standards, of course, came around when the Clean Air Act was put into place back in 1970, and this is the 50th year, the celebration year for this act. The American Lung Association recognizes it as the preeminent public health measure that the government has instituted. It has saved thousands of lives, billions of dollars in costs for medical costs and lost work and lost productivity. Even as the economy has grown over those decades, we know that air pollution levels have clearly been improved, but we're not there yet. And every 5 years, the Act requires the standard to be looked at again based on whatever the current science is showing, because the science continues to progress. And the EPA is to establish independent science advisory groups to look at the science and then to give advice to the administrator on setting the standards.
So if air pollution levels have improved, and probably in direct relationship to the Clean Air Act, but if air pollution standard has improved, then why does this need updated? Why do these standards need to be tougher?
We want to make sure that the standard is telling people the truth about the quality of the air they're breathing. It's one thing to say you have an air quality standard and you're meeting that standard, but if the standard itself does not adequately protect public health, that still leaves many people vulnerable and at risk and experiencing health problems. And that's the situation we're in now, because we know that in many places the fine particle pollution standard is met. But it doesn't mean that the science shows that it doesn't mean that people are experiencing health problems from the air pollution that they are breathing. And we want to make sure that people are told the truth, that air quality standards need to be set at a level that not only is adequate to protect the health of an average individual, but also those who have enhanced vulnerability to air pollution. So those populations, children, the elderly, people with heart and lung disease, people of color, as you pointed out, and people with low socioeconomic status are at greater risk. And courts have repeatedly found that if a certain level of a pollutant adversely affects the health of those sensitive individuals, EPA must strengthen the entire national standard. And that's where the science clearly has been and is now even more strongly showing that the standard really does need to be changed to tell people what the truth is.
Is there any evidence, Kevin, that we mentioned Central Pennsylvania being traditionally one of the areas that has a higher level of particle pollution? Is there any evidence that there are more cases of people suffering from asthma attacks or having heart attacks, having heart disease, lung disease, or irritants to their lungs? Any evidence that there's more of that because there are higher levels of particle pollution here in Central Pennsylvania?
There is certainly evidence of that. I will cite a couple things. There's something called the Harvard Six City Study, which has followed hundreds of thousands of people over time. And they found that for every 1 microgram per cubic meter change in the fine particle pollution levels, that would, if you improve their exposure by that much, that would result in about 34,000 fewer deaths per year across the country. And there's no reason to believe that South Central Pennsylvania would be in any respect left out of that equation. We know that the science is clearly there to show that kind of effect. There's also been the most recent evidence from the Harvard School of Public Health that found that an increase by that amount in long-term average exposure, that was associated with an 8% increase in the COVID-19 death rate. And that's something that we recognize as preliminary work because it is a moving target and we are just months into this epidemic. But we do know that that is perfectly consistent with evidence that we've seen over time that shows that when people are exposed to fine particle pollution, they are more vulnerable to infections.
Okay, you used a term that I have to say that probably most people aren't familiar with, including me, microgram. What is a microgram?
Yeah, right, right.
Explain that.
A microgram is a millionth of a gram, a tiny amount of mass. But the issue isn't so much how tiny it is. The question is in what form that comes. And we know that these particles, you can get many, many particles in a microgram when you're considering that the size of the particles are you can line dozens or even hundreds of these fine particle pollutants across the diameter of a human hair. We know that the largest of the particles, you could probably fit about 30 of them across the average human hair. And so that's the largest of the particles that we're concerned about. And we know that they come much, much smaller. So when you look at those particles, you're breathing in thousands and thousands of them, and those are the ones that can carry those pollutants into the deepest parts of the body. So that's where what we're talking about there. But I don't necessarily want to give you too much technical information here.
I just wanted to bore
the listeners here with that.
No, I just wanted to clarify because it was a term that was unfamiliar. We'll talk more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The EPA is proposing to maintain standards for particulate matter. It's referred to several ways, but particle pollution may be the easiest way to understand. Something that we breathe all the time in the central Pennsylvania is a hotspot for particle pollution throughout the country. Our guest is Kevin Stewart, Director of Environmental Health at American Lung Association, who opposes keeping these standards where they are. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Kevin, if there is no change, if EPA keeps these standards, what happens?
Well, there's evidence that from history that if the EPA fails to recognize the science, there will almost certainly be legal challenges to the standard, because if EPA fails to recognize the science, in fact, the science that EPA itself has indicated, for instance, the risk assessment conducted by the Environmental Protection Agency found that a large number of premature deaths are attributable to fine particle pollution exposure under the current standard. So if that's EPA's own analysis, it's going to be brought against them in a court of law to say, why didn't you follow your own science in setting this standard? And that's where I expect this to go, and I expect that a proper legal decision will be rendered.
What's EPA's motivation here? Why do they want to keep the standards where they are?
I can't speak for the Environmental Protection Agency. I can speak certainly for public health, and the standard is currently, even if a place meets the standard, people are dying from fine particle pollution. People are getting sick, and that's completely unacceptable, and the Lung Association wants to protect people's health.
So the place is not meeting the standards. What happens? What do they do? What does EPA do to them? How are they encouraged to make changes?
Well, here's the thing. The way the law is set up, a standard is set, and then states are required to put in place implementation plans to meet the standard in a certain period of time. The idea is that the EPA then holds states accountable for making progress in a timely way to meet the standards. If states don't, EPA does have the power to apply sanctions to states to say, look, you can't get certain kinds of funding and so on as incentive to make sure that the standards are met. The problem here that we're talking about is that the standard itself is poor and inadequate, not strict enough, and is allowing people to continue to get sick and die as a result of exposure to fine particle pollution, even if it meets the standard. And so the standard does need to be changed to reflect reality, what actually is killing people.
Let's take a phone call from Faith on line two. Faith, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, given the current political climate, what's the most effective thing that the general public, somebody like me, can do to influence the EPA? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
All right, Faith, thank you for your call. What about that, Kevin?
Sure, Scott. The docket, so-called docket for decision, for filing comments on the proposal is open until June 29. So there is still time for people to go to either, you know, you can Google EPA fine particles pollution comments. That's one way to find it. Regulations.gov, I think, is a way that people can go and online and find out very, very quickly. Certainly the American Lung Association has some information online about fine particle pollution. And we do have at stateoftheair.org right now a letter that we'd encourage people to sign to say that they want the Environmental Protection Agency to make sure that the standards for fine particle pollution and for ozone air pollution are strong enough to protect public health. So we want people to sign those. But those are some opportunities that people can take, and we encourage people to tell EPA to sign the petition at the Lung Association site at stateoftheair.org.
You know, Faith brings up a point, and it's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the program today to talk about this, is that the nation's attention has been focused on COVID-19 and issues of race over the past month or so. These changes, and there are others that the EPA is proposing, aren't getting noticed. I mean, there's a lot of news not getting attention right now, but EPA has enacted or has proposed some changes. And okay, maybe we can say this isn't a change, but they're proposing to keep these standards the same. The public's attention has been diverted. They're really not paying attention to this.
I certainly believe that it's no accident that the Environmental Protection Agency is using the current focus and proper focus on the COVID-19 crisis produce some actions that are detrimental to public health that aren't getting the kind of attention they normally would get. And I'm certainly grateful for the opportunity today to talk to your listeners, because this is clearly an important thing, and it's a major step that EPA needs to be challenged on.
Kevin, we had someone who has brought up the dust storm that is coming from, or mm-hmm. that cloud of dust from the Sahara, yes, that's making its way into the United States. You know, this seems like something out of a sci-fi movie, quite frankly. But, I mean, could that cause some health problems here in the United States and make it even to central Pennsylvania?
I mean, there's no question that environmental dust, if it's in the right particle size category, can certainly be associated with an increased risk, but it is only a component. It's important to understand that there are still plenty of local sources that we have more direct control of and more immediate control of than what happens to be coming to us from the Sahara Desert.
Lou asks, if the law requires air quality levels to protect the public within an adequate margin of safety, isn't the EPA opening itself up to lawsuits given the current standards are not adequate? I mean, a large lawsuit from citizens.
Yes, and that's the point I was making, that if the standard if EPA ultimately decides that they're going to ignore the science and ignore public comment that's in favor of recognizing what the real science says and insists on maintaining the standard at its current inadequate level, I think you can rest assured that there will be legal challenges based on what what the law requires, and EPA will have to defend itself against what the science actually says.
We actually have a couple of listeners who have suggested that the Amish community and the agricultural Amish community in particular are a great source of pollution in Lancaster County. Is there truth to that?
I really don't know what the relative components are. There are inventory estimates that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection creates to help understand what the sources of air pollution are in each county in the state. And but it's not necessarily divided up by which religious group is doing which activity. And but it's a question that has arisen before, and we understand that there are some practices that may lead to higher air pollution, whether you're talking about such things as open burning or wood burning, or certain agricultural processes where you have lots of ammonia that is released. But at the same time, in terms of what the fraction is of the agricultural component or what the fraction is even of the entire particle pollution pie, I don't have the details right in front of me right now. And I know that there are some estimates from 2017 that could be looked at in more detail.
Well, and also, I would say that the Amish population is relatively small compared to the population overall. Now, that's not to say that it may not contribute, but I'm just pointing that out, that when you're looking at sheer numbers,
right,
that the Amish population is fairly small. So what happens next, Kevin?
Well, what happens next is, you know, we continue to encourage people to issue comments to indicate that they really do want stronger protections for public health. We're going to see how the Environmental Protection Agency takes this information and whether they actually do make the right choice and improve the standard, or if they stick with the current standard. We know that there are going to be challenges. And the American Lung Association will continue to call that out as part of our work to protect public health and to save people's lung health.
Well, Kevin, I'm going to let you go to answer that telephone now. But Kevin Stewart is the Director of Environmental Health at the American Lung Association. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much, Scott.
Thank you. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, by the way, we are joined by Pennsylvania's State Attorney General Josh Shapiro, and there are a couple of issues that we'll be discussing with the Attorney General. One is a couple of police reforms that have been proposed here in Pennsylvania in the legislature, actually moving their way through the legislature. We'll be talking with the Attorney General about that. But also, we'll be talking about child abuse. This is something that during the whole COVID-19 pandemic has probably not gotten as much attention as it should. And that is, you have a lot of children who are at home with parents, or maybe with step parents, with just others, and there have not been as many child abuse reports coming in. Now, on the surface, that would seem to be a good thing, but it may not be. And it may mean that there are some kids out there that have suffered during this this pandemic of being staying at home. And so we'll be talking with the Attorney General about that. Also, Andrew Little from the Family Alliance of Pennsylvania, also talking a little bit more about that. Now, I want to turn to another topic. Unless interrupted by COVID-19, there will be a Major League Baseball season this summer. Details were worked out between Major League team owners and players earlier this week after some sometimes bitter negotiations. The season will include 60 games, many new rules to keep players safe from COVID-19, and there will be no fans in the stands. Probably understand today that in Texas they're talking about maybe allowing up to 50% of the stadiums to be, we'll put it this way, 50% capacity in the stadiums in Texas. And so we're wondering, what would this season look like? We're joined by journalist Andrew Linker, who has authored books on baseball, blogs on baseball, and was the Harrisburg Senators beat writer for a long time for the Patriot News. Andrew Linker, glad that you're with us this morning.
Thanks, Scott. Nice to be here with you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Talking baseball this morning. Unless interrupted by COVID-19 was what I said in my introduction. Saw a story this morning that everything will be determined by the virus. Players will contract the virus. Some already have. And how many could determine what happens this season. So with all that said, that seems as though that's going to be the shadow on this shortened major league season. Would you agree, Andrew?
Absolutely, 100%. And I big, you know, your word unless, which, you know, is the same thing. It's a big if. And as you say, everything, you know, they're going to test these fellows twice a day, and there are all kind of protocols if somebody tests positive, what they do, how they shut them down. But as we can see, unfortunately, so far, it can spread so quickly. You could go through a team and no problem at all, and then, you know, then what do you do? How do you have a 60-game season if you have a team or two teams, maybe three teams, that are incapacitated by this?
And when you say incapacitated, I mean, they have set some roster rules so that there are some people, some players that can fill in. The rosters are a little bit bigger to start this 60-game season. But say 10, 15 players on a team are test positive for COVID-19 and have to be quarantined. What do those teams do?
Well, they're going to have at least to start the season, and I hate to sound cynical, I'll believe it when I see the first pitch, just because there's so much time between now and when the players report for spring training 2.0 and when this 60-game season actually starts on July 23rd. Right now, you're looking at a 30-man active roster that'll be trimmed a little bit as the season goes on with a 30-player taxi squad. So if you did have some players come down with the virus, you would be able to bring up fellows from the taxi squad. But you also have a situation where you can only have three of those 30 players on the taxi squad travel with the team when they're on the road. So if you have an outbreak, all of a sudden, you're going to be shorthanded possibly for a game or two. And in a 60-game season, all these games are magnified that much more.
So when you said that you'll believe it when you see it, when you see that first pitch, so you're pessimistic that there actually will be a season?
I'd love to see a season. Yeah, but there's so many bigger things going on right now, and there's so much as you mentioned, so much posturing and bickering going on with the Players Association and the owners in the last couple of months, I don't think it would take much for this house of cards to kind of collapse, whether you have a wide outbreak on a particular team that might go, hey, you know what, this isn't the best idea. We just ought to shut it down. That all remains to be seen. As you said, the virus will dictate what we do, but this virus isn't very cooperative, as unfortunately we have found out much too harshly over the last few months.
You know, one of the other parts of the agreement that was finally reached after these bitter negotiations is that there are actually players who can opt out of playing this season. Now,
yes,
it's probably too soon since the agreement was reached. I haven't heard of any players that have decided to do that. But, for example, Bryce Harper, the Phillies, his wife is pregnant. Mm-hmm. Just found out that his wife is pregnant. I mean, remember, these are people too, and they will be living with their spouses, and they may come in contact with other family members or other people who have tested positive. So I'm wondering, what do you see, Andrew, if there will be players who will opt out?
I think you will have that, not just in a situation where Bryce Harper and his wife are expecting their second child, and that's a serious consideration for Bryce Harper. But if you're a player and anybody in your family that you have immediate contact with, let's say is going through chemotherapy or has respiratory issues, pre-existing conditions there, you can opt out and without prejudice, without penalty from the teams. You know, it's one of the things that they hammered out, and I think that's the the humane thing to do. Don't force somebody to work and possibly bring this this virus home and really impact so many other people.
So say there is a season, Andrew, 60 games. I mean, baseball has always been described as, you know, with 162 games in a normal regular season, as the long haul. This would seem to be a sprint toward the finish. What do you see for 60-game season? This is unprecedented.
Well, it is in baseball, but not in sport. If you remember in 1994-95, the National Hockey League, because of its lockout, shortened its season from the usual 80 games to 48. And that made for a very exciting season for the NHL, because every game was magnified. Every game was crucial. And a 60-game season for baseball, it's just like that. And any team now can win a division and make the playoffs with a hot start, or you can lose it with a slow start. And a couple of examples, the Pittsburgh Pirates, a few times over the last several seasons, have come out of the gates playing so well, and 60 games into the season, they were right there for a playoff spot. Then of course, they would fade in those seasons. Last year, for example, the Phillies were off to a decent start, and they started sliding backwards when Andrew McCutchen was injured and out for the season. That happened to come in the 60th game of the season, by the way. And one other good example from last season, the Washington Nationals, who eventually won the World Series, they were 19-31 after 50 games. There's no way in a 60-game season they would have come close to making the playoffs. So everything's magnified now with the 60-game season. And a three-game series is 1/20th of your season, so you don't get swept. Those are big games.
There are some different roles, including the designated hitter being used in the National League. One that I have to say, as a traditionalist, I really don't care for, but it's been used in the minor leagues now for a couple of years. When extra innings start, having a man on second base, a runner on second base to start each extra inning. So talk about some of those roles, some of the things that will be different.
Well, there are going to be a lot of things different. As you mentioned, the DH will be universal for at least this season. In the minor leagues, which they've done since the last couple seasons, you get to that 10th inning and you start with a runner on second base. And to me, it was just a contrived way to get games finished earlier. I'm like you. I'm a traditionalist. I don't like it. I see it every night over at the Senators game, that potential there. And I just feel like I'm that emoji with a guy, you know, face palming himself. I just don't like the rule. But you know, it's interesting. There are a lot of do's and don'ts that a player has to know now before he ever steps on the field or swings a bat or throws the ball. You know, for now you can't argue within 6 feet of umpires. You know, somewhere's Billy Martin and Earl Weaver are not liking this rule at all. Pitchers can no longer lick their fingers to make the ball wet for themselves, which is kind of a gross habit to begin with. Now they'll be able to have a wet rag in their back pocket. No spitting tobacco or sunflower seeds. That's a no-no. Can't do that now. Gum's okay, though. You can't high five, can't fist bumps, and there'll be no hugging in baseball this year. And whenever possible, players are supposed to be practicing social distancing of 6 feet. And if you're not in the game or you're not going to be in the game in a situation coming off the bench, you're not even supposed to be in the dugout. If you're not pitching that day, you're not supposed to be in the dugout. You're not supposed to touch your face, which is going to be really hard for coaches at third base to give signals.
Yeah, really.
You know as well as I do, they love touching their face. They were born to be coaches, and they were born touching their face, their elbows. So they can't do it with their face anymore. There'll be no bat boys or bat girls. And you know, traditionally, Scott, as you well know from baseball, if one of your teammates makes a last out of an inning, you go get his glove and bring it out to him so he doesn't have to go back to the dugout to get his glove. No. Now you got to go back and get your own glove. There's no more lineup card exchanges before the game. That's all going to be done by computer app. And what will surely really be a downer to the players is there'll be no pregame or postgame buffet spreads in the clubhouse. You got to you gotta bring your own, basically. Everybody's packing a snack.
Yeah, that's probably one of the reasons a lot of people like being in the big leagues. We're going to be joined by Harrisburg Senators President Kevin Culp in just a moment to talk about the minor leagues. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. So there will be Major League Baseball, as you've heard with Andrew Linker. That is, if COVID-19 doesn't strike the players and those on the field too hard. But what about the minor leagues, where so many fans go to watch baseball here in central Pennsylvania? Joining our conversation now is Kevin Culp, president of the Harrisburg Senators. Mr. Culp, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot, Scott. Good to talk to you. Hi, Andy. How you doing?
Hi, Kevin. How you doing today?
I'm doing great.
You guys...
I'd rather see Kevin at the ballpark than talk to him on the phone.
I understand where you're coming from, but I think that, you know, that brings up a point that, you know, Andrew, you were talking about changes. Post-game interviews with players will now have to happen remotely, which we've all grown to know. I can't say we've grown to love it, but there will be no in-person interviews even after games. So, Kevin Culp, let's talk about minor league baseball. We established that it looks like there may be a major league baseball season this year. What about the minor leagues?
Well, you know, I have been following and really am hopeful that the major leagues can get there season in. It'd be fun to watch for all the reasons you and Andy were talking about. Obviously, there's a lot of challenges, but as it relates to the minor leagues, it doesn't really translate. You know, for us, there hasn't been a lot of conversations lately. There's been no official word from Major League Baseball in regards to the status of our season. I think the writing is on the wall, though, that there wouldn't be an opportunity for us to put fans in our ballpark. And if there's no fans in a ballpark in the minor leagues, there really is no revenue opportunity. Now, the major leagues have their TV deals that are very lucrative, and there's a lot of incentive for them to play without fans. For us, it's not that way. So if there is no fans in our stands and there's no real opportunity to do that this summer, it's pretty clear that the season is going to get canceled. It just hasn't been done officially yet. I'm assuming now that the major leagues have kind of worked out their agreement with the players that we might be next on the pecking order to kind of get formally resolved. But I feel like all 162 minor league teams are kind of operating now under the assumption that this is going to be a lost season.
So the Senators, as the AA affiliate of the Washington Nationals, you have to get the okay from the major league affiliate to be able to play?
Well, we have to get players from them. They provide all of our players. Our working agreement with them, they provide all the players and all the coaches, and we basically have, you know, a very loose. You know, we have a great agreement with them where we provide certain things, they provide certain things. But with no players, if they don't provide us any players, we can't have a season. And quite frankly, like in a lot of the states, the Eastern League has teams right now. We wouldn't be able to play with fans anyways, even if they did provide us players. So,
there'd be no revenue, yeah. Well, okay, there are a couple issues there. One, and I'll take it from a fan's perspective first, and then we'll talk about player development. But from a fan's perspective, you know, I've already heard, and Andy, you can weigh in on this too, I've already heard people who were so soured on professional baseball because these negotiations became so bitter. I mean, I heard, and I'm assuming these are casual fans because the hardcore fans will not abandon the sport, saying that baseball's dead to me, or I don't care if they ever settle this. But the minor leagues is where so many people go for entertainment on a nightly basis and where there's so many kids. And missing that year of minor league baseball, I just hurt. It really has to hurt the sport overall. Would you agree with that, Kevin?
Oh, it's devastating. I mean, we are, for the most part, an industry full of relatively small businesses that are, you know, trying to be very positive influences in their communities, do the right thing. But there's not a lot of, not a lot of us are equipped to deal with a completely lost season. You know, by the time we play next April, we'll have gone 18 months with no with no home games, and it's going to be very hard. And we are, you know, here in Harrisburg, we are fortunate. We do have a very good, dedicated working group that is dedicated to making sure we get over this hump. But there's a lot of teams across America, I think, that are going to be, really struggling to get financially to get to next April.
Kevin, how many full-time employees do you have?
Well, right now I have 10. We had 23. I've had to furlough a number of them. So now I'm down to 10. And we're going to be looking at doing a number of other things throughout the month of July and August, field rentals, maybe some community events, other ways to use the ballpark, maybe to provide some community activity within the guidelines that are established and whatever maximums and social distancing requirements. So we'll do some little things to try to have some events, but right now I'm down to 10.
Andy, you know, when we were talking about, I just mentioned that, there have been people on social media talking about how upset they were with these negotiations. Mm-hmm. A lot of people went back to the 1994 strike that took away the World Series. I mean, has this situation hurt baseball?
Well, it's hurt baseball, but so many other industries and sports have been hurt. It's certainly not a self-inflicted hurt, as was the 1994 situation that caused the cancellation of the World Series. I mean, this virus has impacted, countless industries, sports from the majors down through to minors, and it doesn't really matter in that sense if it's baseball in the minor leagues or the National Hockey League and the AHL. All those industries have suffered, and I think, baseball, you're dealing with the biggest pie there is financially out there, and everybody wants to get their share, but at the same time, it's this fine dance. They want to get their share. They want to make sure they get their footing in terms of negotiations, because in the last player contract, it was really kind of slanted toward the owners. So the players don't want to give away too much. And fans see this as like billionaires versus millionaires. Where it is, it's a sport, yes. It's a business, definitely. It's also entertainment. Where does entertainment fall under, Kevin? Does it fall under business? Does it fall under sport? Or does it, go on both of these, like a Venn diagram? It's hurt. I think they'll be back. I think people, when they say, I'll never watch it again, they might be able to do that for a week, and then they come back. Baseball has a habit over the years, over the century plus it's been around, where they've survived scandals, they've survived poor management, and they'll survive this virus, and they'll come back, and it might look a little different in terms of how it's played this year. It'll look a little bit different in the new normal, but that goes with all walks of society.
Yeah,
but I think it's going to be popular again pretty darn quick.
Yeah, everyone's kind of forgotten about the Houston Astros sign-stealing scandal. Kevin, we only have a minute or so left. One of the things I did want to ask you about was player development. You're going to have players who played last year in Harrisburg who could be playing next year, but young players who will miss an entire year of their development. I mean, what are they going to do?
Yeah, some guys are going to be able to be part of a taxi squad that you guys were talking about that can kind of keep working out and playing against each other, some intra-squad games. A number of other guys, though, are going to be kind of left out in the cold. And I imagine they're going to do some things in the fall and the winter to try to get those guys some work but you're right. I mean, these are very important years for their development, trying to make sure that they give themselves their best chance to make it to the major leagues, and it certainly isn't helping things.
Kevin Culp is the president of the Harrisburg Senators. Kevin, I hope that it doesn't look like we may see you this season, but be back next year and on City Island and looking forward to games. Journalist Andrew Linker. Andrew, always good to talk to you as well. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro joins us. We'll be talking about child abuse, talking about some police reforms that are being proposed here in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.